It's quite curious to me that the first definition I saw online for the word empath defined a person with a paranormal ability to apprehend the mental or emotional state of another, noting it was chiefly in science fiction. All I can say is truth is stranger than fiction, science or otherwise. Dr. Judith Orloff, MD and author of The Empath's Survival Guide, is embracing the empath as a normal that needs to be understood first by the empaths themselves and then society at large. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Judith, thank you so much for joining us today on Tributaries.
You're very welcome.
Something I'd like you to address right off the bat is the importance of acknowledging some of the information in your book, The Empath's Survival Guide, because it seems there are so many people being otherwise diagnosed or pathologized, and then they're put on these intense pharmaceuticals.
Yes, definitely. Well, you know, I wrote The Empath Survival Guide to give people other strategies to deal with being an empath as compared to the traditional medical perspective. Unfortunately, too many empaths get over-medicated and treated as if there's something wrong with them and pathologized. And so it's important, if you're an empath, to realize that you are an emotional sponge. You might not have the same borders up that other people have or filters to filter out negativity. So life affects you very, very strongly. And your neurological system is wired differently. That's why it's important for you to understand this and to deal with it in the correct way. Now, if you go to a traditional doctor, let's say, and you're feeling, I'm overwhelmed by picking up other people's emotions, or I live with, you know, a negative spouse and it's just taking a toll on me because I'm feeling negative and depleted too, they might not understand that you're absorbing the emotions and energy of the people around you. And so they might give you an antidepressant, let's say, or an anti-anxiety, or a prescription that isn't related to protection techniques that is what you really need to, you know, center and protect yourself so you don't absorb the energy of people around you.
Right. Now, how does your categorizing types of empaths avoid the subset of pitfalls, which is like normalizing into a category, which I think is where Western medicine gets into some problems with diagnosing and then the pharmaceuticals?
Exactly. Well, being an empath is not a disorder. It's a gift. And as we evolve as a culture and as a world, people are opening up, and their sensitivities are opening, their intuition is opening, more people are opening to a spiritual path, yoga, meditation, energy medicine, so it makes sense that they would become more sensitive and empathic along with that, because the path of the heart involves being empathic, and being empathic is caring about what happens to people, caring what happens to the earth. And when you see it being assaulted, it can be quite shocking to your system. And so it's important not to make that into a disorder, but reframe it in such a way where you see yourself as an incredibly gifted, sensitive person who cares about others, who cares about the earth. And if you go to some doctor that tells you that there's something wrong with you, go get a second opinion.
Yes.
Really, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, it's the old school. Now, as a child, I grew up as an empath, and my parents, who were doctors, told me, oh, dear, you just need a thicker skin. You know, you need to be less sensitive. You need to be different. And that felt horrible as a child. And I'm here to tell you, you don't need to do any of those things. You need to develop your abilities and allow them to thrive by learning certain skills. The positive aspects of being an empath are intuition, spirituality. You care about people. You care about the earth. You love nature. You have a deep spiritual connection. You have the potential to go very deep in meditation. And there's so many beautiful qualities to an empath. I would never not want to be an empath. However, you have to learn the very basic skill of not absorbing the world's or other people's stress. That is part of the Empath Manual 101. And that's why I wrote the Empath Survival Guide, because once you get those skills down, your life is going to change dramatically.
Yes, I can only imagine. Now, so you just mentioned earlier, as a collective, it sounds like you do think that humans are becoming more and more empathic.
Oh, I do. Yeah. You know, when I was on the book tour for the Empath Survival Guide, I mean, nearly everyone in the room were empaths, and a lot of them were newly awakened empaths. And they say that the increased stress of the world has beaten down their defenses so that they're just more open, and then they don't know what to do with that. So empaths are awakening all the time, even if they weren't born that way, which is different. You know, I think it's a very positive phenomenon that more and more people are awakening, because when you awaken as an empath, you basically awaken your intuition and your spirituality along with it. And, you know, we're talking about changing the world and what it will take, and what will be the signs that the world is changing. This is one of them.
Yes, absolutely. It seemed to me that your checklist for Am I an Empath might include everybody, and I'm wondering what kind of feedback you're getting. You just mentioned that a lot of people in your audiences are empaths. Does anyone feel like, oh, I'm not an empath, and then they feel slighted or something?
Oh, God. I guess that could happen. But a lot of people aren't empaths. Not everyone is an empath, nor do you have to be. You can be an incredibly spiritual, wonderful person and not be an empath. You know, my partner is not an empath. You know, I live with someone who's not an empath. Thank God. You know, I don't want to live with an empath. I have too much going on in my own body and my own energy that I like that he's grounded. I like that he doesn't feel what I feel. Too much, you know, for me. But some empaths love living together. So it just depends on what you need. And that's what I keep stressing in the book, is that you have to decide as an empath what your needs are. And not everyone is an empath. I just really want to clarify that. It's just a subset of humans. And it's just, if you are an empath, you need to understand yourself and educate your loved ones so they can treat you with respect and dignity.
Yes. Now, you mentioned that you were an empath and you had some challenges that were because of that during your childhood. What is or was your greatest challenge, and maybe how has it evolved or transformed?
I think my greatest challenge was feeling not enough, or that there was something wrong with me and that I had to change. And I wasn't good enough as I was. It was a very deep wound as a child for me, because I never had anyone say, oh, honey, now you're just very sensitive, and this is how you deal with it, and it's great. I had never had that. And I was an only child, and my parents loved me. They were well-meaning. They were both doctors, scientists, but they didn't know about this. And so in my teenage years, I got very heavily involved with drugs and substances to numb my sensitivities, and I wanted to run from who I was, and I really tried hard to do that. But there came a point, and I write about this in my book Second Sight, which talks about my journey and how I ran from my intuition and being an empath, and then how I began integrating it in my life and how I became a physician. But there came a point after a big car accident I had, where I went over a cliff in a car 8 times in Topanga Canyon, where my life began to change, where I started meeting people who said, look, you know, this is not working for you. You know, this is not healthy. You have to somehow integrate your intuition, your empathy into your life and stop running from it. And so at that point, I began to integrate it and realize there wasn't, you know, a fault in me. I wasn't, you know, there wasn't a defect in me, because I was so sensitive. And I want to tell everyone the same is true for you. You know, if you feel that you're defective or you're pathological or you're too sensitive and you should be a different way, I really invite you to take another look at that, because it's not true.
Well, I think being an empath or not, so many children because the world is a pretty darn foreign place on a lot of levels, feel that separation, and then that turns into denial of self. And you make a great statement at some point in your book where you say, the spirit within me is greater than any addiction or fear. I am not my fear. I am larger. And what is a one step or a first step to making that more than just wise words to say?
Yeah, well, just to realize that fear is when you're in your head or your smaller self. And there is a way to shift into your larger self that, you know, looks down on everything and has a wider perspective than fear, and that can see that love is stronger than fear. And the way to do that is through the 3-minute heart meditation that I use throughout every day, that I've used for, you know, 20, 30 years every day to get me out of my fear, to get me out of my small-minded thinking. And breathe, center, put your hand over your heart chakra, which is in the middle of the chest, and get in the practice of opening it by focusing on something very loving, by calming yourself down with the breath and feeling the sensation of love. And that will transport you to a larger part of yourself, and it will get you out of your fear. But it sometimes takes practice.
Oh, very definitely, I would say, yes.
Yeah, but you just keep doing, I mean, I do it all the time. I can't tell you how many times I do this because I love it so much. I don't want to stay trapped in fear. It's horrible. It hurts, yeah. You know, and it's not going anywhere. And so to consciously shift out of that, you can do it through the heart practice. And you're just a little bit more each day, just a little wider, a little more open. You feel a little bit more in that area. And pretty soon you get there, and that's your relief.
Yes, and I also think it's important lots of times to not judge our own progress in that direction.
Sure. Yeah, we just do the best we can. And I'm a big believer in baby steps. You know, a little bit each day, you know, just being able to set one boundary as an empath. Being able to say, no, I'm sorry, I can't go out tonight because I'm too tired. Now, that is a huge victory. And I, as a psychiatrist and in my personal life, I celebrate huge victories of my patients and of myself. I mean, I celebrate the tiny things that we do every day to move forward because I know intuitively these have big bursts of light. And although the mind will tell you, oh, it's just a little thing, it might not be enough, the heart knows what a blast of light that creates when you move forward a tiny little step. So I'd like everyone to really enjoy and acknowledge their small steps.
You write also that an empath's body is different. How so? Is there anything physical? Are they all sensory or in the energetic realm?
Well, I think we're wired differently neurologically. I think that we feel things much more strongly than other people, and that we're able to sense and know things, you know, at a much more intense capacity than other people. And so, yes, I think there are some physical differences. You know, we have a hyperactive mirror neuron system, which means our compassion neurons are more active. And what that means is that they're hyperactive, so we're constantly feeling compassion for people on the street, for people we hear about in the news, for our friends.
Is there anything in scientific research that is moving in this direction for the study of empaths?
Yes, a study in terms of the mirror neuron system, the compassion system in the brain, and there's also been interesting study on the hormone dopamine. Dopamine is the pleasure hormone, and it's been proven that extroverts need a lot more of a dopamine boost in their system to feel pleasure and to feel satisfied. And they get that boost through being with large groups of people, going to football games, going to large stadiums, and getting that huge extroverted dopamine boost, whereas empaths and sensitive people have been shown to require less dopamine to feel happy. So they can feel happy meditating or reading a book or cooking lunch. And so they require less of a dopamine rush to feel happy, which is a huge difference between extroverts, introverts, and empaths and non-empaths.
I'm wondering if you have an extrovert, for instance, needing more dopamine, I guess they are just intuitively pushed in the direction of a large football game or a huge concert or something, whereas I would think maybe they would just have more dopamine if that's what their thing is.
No, dopamine needs to be stimulated by something. And if they have a great need to have more dopamine and they get more of it by going to a football game than they do by meditating at home, they're probably going to go to the football game. And so that's a motivator for extroverts, whereas an empath can feel happy going in a bath and lying in a bath with a candle and looking at the moon. That can make an empath very happy. And so that's a quieter activity that requires less of a dopamine boost.
Yes. And where would addictive personalities fit in there?
Yeah, great question. There's a chapter in the book on empaths and addiction. And many empaths do become addicted to substances, food, sex, shopping, debting, many, many things to try and numb the sensory overstimulation that's going on in their lives. You know, you reach for a drug to calm yourself down, or you reach for alcohol when you start absorbing energy from other people and you don't know what to do about it. And so as a psychiatrist, I treat a lot of people who are in 12-step recovery programs who are also recovering empaths, who need to learn how to stay clean and sober and be an empath, which is, you know, a very common theme. And so many addicts and alcoholics are extremely sensitive people, and they just haven't learned to deal with their sensitivities. So if you're struggling with an addiction, then it's important to look at the empath component of it to see, you know, what you can do to practice self-care and strengthen yourself.
Yes, it's a hugely important piece. So thank you for sharing that and for, of course, putting it into your book. One of your protection strategies for therapists is to not try to fix your patients/clients. And this is so important, and it reverberates on so many levels, doesn't it?
It really does, because empaths are fixers. They want to get in there and make you feel better. They want to get in there and fix your problems so you're happy. And that doesn't work. And nor is it respectful. And so as an empathic therapist, the way I work with people is to more hold the space for someone and offer them guidance rather than fixing. Fixing is a particular strategy. And it reflects on the amount of discomfort you have with the other person's pain, that you can't stand it when they're in pain, or you want to remove the pain in some way, rather than, you know, giving guidance and being supportive, but not trying to fix. So it's a very specific thing to be aware of in yourself. If you notice you're a fixer, no, if you're, let's say your spouse comes home with a problem and he or she is very, very upset, you don't want to get into immediate fixing of it. You want to hold a space, an empathic space, for that person to express themselves. And that's where people get into trouble, because you just want to fix it. And that's not the proper path to take, you know, with a lot of people in the beginning, maybe down the line if they ask you for help. But you have to trust, and this is one thing I've learned as a therapist over all these years, is to trust the healing impulse in people. Now, if somebody comes to me to work on their issues in therapy, I trust that something is in motion there that they will connect to, that will help them fix themselves, basically, along with my guidance.
Yes, and especially if we're coming from a place of fixing someone, that's a huge implying that there's something wrong with them. So that adds a whole other layer, I think.
Exactly. Exactly. The way I view life is that we're here on Earth, and Earth is a place of light and darkness. It's both. And I don't think it will ever be anything different, because that's the purpose of it. But, you know, again, I could be wrong. But given that premise, then it's our job to deal with the darkness within ourselves and the fear and the insecurity and the lack of faith, everything we all have, so that we can transcend that and develop more light in ourselves and thus more light in the planet. You see, so I just look at that as why we're here. So when patients come in or friends go through crisis, you know, going through something intense, that's just what this is about here. And hopefully we can do it with as much love and understanding and sensitivity as possible without trying to fix somebody. Because that means, you know, you're taking away their healing powers. And you're saying, the great me has the ability to fix you.
The great
and,
me.
And it's just something to compassionately look at in yourself. These are evaluations one needs to make as an empath and also as a human being.
Whether someone is an empath or whether I or you are an empath, if we all could just come from a place of loving kindness, we wouldn't have to worry about any of the above. We could all give each other the space we need to move forward and maybe a pie in the sky kind of attitude, but I think we can move toward that.
Yeah, I think we can move toward that, but also realize that loving kindness sometimes means setting boundaries. And it sometimes means saying no with kindness. It doesn't mean saying yes to everything, and that's where empaths get into trouble, where they overcommit and they say yes to too much, when really they want to say no. And I love what Pema Chodron, the Buddhist nun and spiritual teacher, says. She calls something idiot compassion, where people say yes when they mean to say no. So we don't want to do that. Now, there is a place for saying no with loving kindness.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah,
so could you share a bit about actually moving from protecting ourselves to experiencing and maximizing benefits of self?
Yeah. Well, protection techniques are necessary. Boundaries are one of them. You have to learn how to say no. You have to learn how to say, I'm not able to take on this commitment right now. Or I'm not able to listen to you for an hour if you go around in circles. It just tires me out too much. You know, there's certain things you need to practice saying no to in your life so you don't get drained. If you don't learn that, you will be exhausted. So it's kind of definite thing you have to learn. You can't get around not learning it if you want to be an empowered empath. And I want to tell you also, I have an empath survival guide online course that people can take, which is a video course where I go through all the various topics of how to use protection techniques in your life at work, in relationships, with health, and so forth. So that's an option after our show. And so you need to learn these protection techniques, and meditation is very, very powerful. I practice it every day. And it's a time when I quiet everything down, go into my heart, connect to myself, and then connect to something larger than myself, which is so important. And when you're able to have a few of these techniques in place, then you can really enjoy your gifts. Now you can really go out, to a party or go out wherever you want to go and not be afraid of getting lambasted by all this energy and not knowing what to do with it. And now you know what to do with it. So you sort of, gain a mastery, ongoing mastery of how to deal with energy when it's coming at you. You know, so that's a very important sense of mastery to have. If you don't have that, people become housebound. They don't want to go out of the house. You know, empaths just feel there's too much to deal with out there. I'm going to stay home with my animals, which is okay, but you also want to learn how to protect yourself as well and how to center yourself.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm messing too much with the word protection here, so you can let me know. But yeah. I feel like also once you get into recognizing and realizing, oh, I have empathic tendencies or I am an empath, I need to do certain things. Isn't there a time and a place to let go of protection? And I'm not talking, of course, someone can say, no, I'm not going out tonight or I'm not going to engage in whatever is. But I think if we continue on the road protecting ourselves all the time, then there's a separation that happens ultimately. And like Bruce Lipton, for instance, talks about how a cell or a body cannot simultaneously be in a protective mode and a growth mode at the same time. So do you see the protective mode as being temporary, and then we can move beyond that into a space where we know ourselves well enough so we don't have to create a separation? We can be more in the flow and let things just flow through us.
Yes, and the protection techniques I'm suggesting are used just for temporary measures. They're not, I don't walk around protecting myself every moment of every day. So I love being open, and I love being receptive, and I love feeling life. But if I go to a dinner and I know there's somebody who's going to be criticizing me, you know, I'm probably not going to sit next to them, you know, or I'll take care of myself, or I'll get to the point where their criticism will just mean nothing to me, you know, so it doesn't bother me at all.
Right.
It depends. I mean, I think ideally, you know, the whole idea is to transcend all of this so that it doesn't get you. But to get to that point of transcendence takes a little work.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
The respect really comes from the personal first, allowing ourselves to work and to get to know our gut and what we're really feeling.
Yes, and it's a journey, truly. You know, this lifetime we're given, this time, this gift of time we're given here in a physical form, and being an empath in a physical form, you know, is a particularly wonderful gift. I've always, you know, somaticized my whole life, and I was told that was bad to somaticize. But another way of interpreting that is that your body is sending you messages to listen to at those moments. If I get a stomach ache, I go, oh, okay. Now, what's this telling me? And so I listen to my body's signals. If you don't listen, then you'll be in bad shape.
You mentioned earlier that you've been on a book tour with this book, The Empath Survival Guide. What's the temperature out there? I just wondered what you were feeling from other professionals, perhaps.
The temperature is hot. And I was just quoted in the New York Times yesterday on empaths, which for me is a giant victory. To get in a mainstream publication talking about empaths in the science section, I mean, in terms of the greater message, it feels fantastic. I think because of what's happening with world events and, you know, how narcissism is just in our face every moment of every day in so many different forms, and narcissism is a form of empathy deficient disorder, that empathy is rising up, you know, in its true power that it deserves. And the importance of what it means to have empathic leadership, to have empathic teachers, to be empathic people versus self-absorbed narcissists who just care about themselves. So we're seeing both poles of this. Everyone listening to this show, it begins with you, and that's not a cliche. It is absolutely true. And every change you make in yourself, this will move us ahead individually and as a human race.
And as Judith Orlov says, we are here to tip the balance toward the light. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is at iTunes as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.